Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Lightning Meditations podcast. I am your host, Cyrus, and I'm joined today by Zohar, Anne, Francis, Genevieve, and Nico. A full house tonight. All right. Now, we are going to get right ahead with it. And I want to bring up Wednesday's meditation and the quote for Wednesday from Leo Strauss is, "A man whom one trusts is not yet a friend. A servant or a bodyguard must be trustworthy, but there is no reason why they ought to be one's friends." Again, a man whom one trusts is not yet a friend. A servant or a bodyguard must be trustworthy, but there is no reason why they ought to be one's friends. What is a friend?
Before I answer that, I have to share another quotation that one made me think
excellent.
Of
yeah.
from Hegel. I think you guys will appreciate this. No man is a hero to his valet. This is not because the hero is not a hero, but because the valet is a valet.
Wow. These quotes are incredible. They pair so well together. Man.
Can you repeat that quote? No man is a
hero. No man is a hero to his valet. This is not because the hero is not a hero, but because the valet is a valet.
But can't you see the only things that pair as well, like trust and friendship, heroes and valets, peanut butter and jelly, Lego and Star Wars, EDM music and ancient music. It just these are just great wine and cheese.
So, Nico, did you ask who's the valet? What is a valet?
No, so my question is, like, is Sancho Panza the valet of Don Quixote?
I think, like, in the narrow sense, right, the valet is like you park your car and the person who parks your car is the valet. Like, that's how we experience valet.
I think it's quite different. I think it's more like a golf caddy where they're like intimately involved with your process
your
success. But yeah. Butler, maybe like Alfred is a butler to Batman, but not like these sort of service, like strict service roles. I think there's a very intimate relationship there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, I mean, since you mentioned Hegel, like you could push this into some sort of master and slave dialectic between the hero, you know, just like doing his thing and the valet doing all of the work.
Well, we're in slave dialectic. That's like a trigger warning right there. Even just mentioning it. Part of the history of thought. This is Hegel, and he's making a point. Can you explain why Batman and Robin are part of Hegelian master slave dialectic, and explain what that means?
That's for me.
That's for you, Nico.
That's for me.
Okay. I don't think, first of all, that Batman and Robin fit that scenario because I think they're partners in justice or in crime, for that matter. I think that the proper account is Sancho Panza and Don Quixote. Because, like, you have Don Quixote doing his thing, you know, being a crazy lunatic, you know, having all of these hallucinations throughout the land. And Sancho there on his donkey, like carrying him throughout, like through his sickness and through everything. So in this sense, Don Quixote is not a hero for Sancho, you know?
It's sort of like Francis and John Keats.
Yeah. No man is a genius to his assistant.
But I think reason I mentioned it in relationship to the Strauss quote is because I think it suggests that our identities aren't fixed, but highly contextual, and that different relationships have different energies. And so this hero that's sort of out there in the world being idolized doesn't have that dynamic with the person that knows him or her in this more intimate sense, or knows them through the lens of, like, you know, so to say, putting on their tie. And seeing them with the strange fight before they go on and like win over the crowd. And if a bodyguard, similarly, you have to be able to trust that person, not just with your body, but also with your vulnerability. Like, they're going to see certain things about you and know certain patterns of where you're going and who you're hanging out with that maybe diverge from your persona. but they're not necessarily that trust, which is maybe deeper than the trust you would even give to a friend, somehow doesn't add up to friendship. So then I think it raises an interesting question, which is like, are we more authentic with the bodyguard or with the friend? Or if we're, or if authenticity is like one aspect of connection, it's clearly not, it's the floor, but not the ceiling. Because otherwise we would just hang out with our bodyguards, right?
Right.
We wouldn't be friends.
Going to the think prompt, what does it require beyond trust?
I think it does relate to the master slave. Sorry, one more point, which is the master slave dialectic. I think here is like, what if there's an element of healthy competition that we have with our friends, and we don't have that with the bodyguard? Because with the bodyguard, there's a sort of an assumed hierarchy where you are the dominant one and they're the submissive one. And actually, because that hierarchy is established, you're not challenged by the bodyguard to strive. Whereas like, if you have your study buddy or your running partner, you're trying to beat them. And maybe that's good for you in some way, even though it's also kind of painful when they win.
To put this, move this into psychology and move it into dangerous territory. This reminds me of one of Freud's theories of sexual attraction in humans, where like as we become, and you see it even in Esther Perel really runs with this whole idea that like the more intimate we become with our partner and the more we move into a high trust, long-term partnership, the more the mystery tends to go away and therefore the more we struggle with attraction. And I mean, isn't that the same thing all over again? Like no man is a hero to his wife. Like it's like a thing of it.
Yes, honey, you know, like shut up.
I can, yeah, I like, can no, hear the
no, no, I can't no hear magician.
Me?
Like, oh, Genevieve. Well, okay, sorry. Well, in kink dynamics, guys, the dom versus sub, right? I mean, no, really, but a sub actually has a great deal of so-called power, right? What is actually really power in this dynamic? And that the sub is actually, the consent is power. Because, so.
I love it. Like, I have moments almost every day where I wait for the, I'm waiting for the FBI to show up, you know, the American FBI to show up in Chiang Mai and knock my door and say, it is illegal to have this much fun. Remote work is not supposed to be fun. You're definitely not supposed to do podcasts with your colleagues, everyone wearing sunglasses.
That's what the sunglasses are for. Definitely,
yeah.
Safe.
Definitely yeah. The CEO of a business unit should not mention kink dynamics.
Sorry,
let's go by our DJ names. What's your DJ name again? Let's just not pretend that you're Genevieve anymore.
You're waiting for the FBI to come and dominate you, Francis?
So absolutely wild. Absolutely. I'm fucking, yeah. Oh my
I would not consent to that. No consent.
But you have the power
the thought
if you
I
do
have
so.
Is that like dom and sub, you have very defined roles, just like, and the, like the guidelines around them are very clear and very, very defined. And I think it's the same with the bodyguard and the person they're protecting. Whereas I think friendship has like a multiplicity of roles and almost kind of like a lack of definition. And so maybe like that factors into like the distinction of these relationships is that it actually lacks some sort of like defined edge or boundary.
What's interesting in pop culture is that like being put in the so-called friend zone is like a punishment, or like at least like sort of in like sort of like bro culture, there's this idea of like you don't want to be put in the friend zone, but maybe you do. Like maybe the highest calling, if we go back to Aristotle, friendship is like the ultimate, is you want to be the friend. Hafiz and Rumi refer to God as the friend, right? And what you really don't want to be is put in the bodyguard zone. So it's interesting to sort of flip it and say the friend zone, if only people appreciated that the friend zone has no definition, and yet people are referring to it as something that has definition. They're misunderstanding the meaning of friendship, which is very sad. in a way.
I think that's the whole point of the friend zone, is that they fundamentally misunderstand the meaning of friendship with women specifically. So yes, I agree with that.
I think Nico is going to bring up Carl Schmitt.
No, I mean, no, but my point was much simpler than invoking, you know, theory of the partisan and other stuff we're talking about on that chat group. But I was just going to say that there is no contract in friendship. So there are no, and per the, I mean, there is no mediation, you know, in a friendship. Like, you're just there with your friend, I guess. Like, when you have a group dynamic, that might be a bit more complicated, but on the one-to-one basis, there is no contract. So a master and a slave there is an implicit contract in the master and slave dialectic. There is an implicit contract between, let's say, Sancho Panza and Don Quixote. And to go to the Dom and the Sub thing, which I think is very interesting. So I'm not going to like diverge into this, but masochism, no? By definition, if you like study it like philosophically, like people have done this, is the establishment of a contract between the way that pleasure is going to be achieved. So that's why, like, you know, what is a masochist? Someone who understands that pleasure comes after pain. So you have to be, let's say, contracted into a relationship of pain first. Anyway, yeah, so.
I'm ready to keep talking about this.
I mean, there's a book by, I'll just continue for like a minute. There's a book by Gilles Deleuze, French philosopher from like the second half of the 20th century on, it's called Coldness and Cruelty. I think it's his best work. I mean, it's my favorite, which is a critique on the novel Venus in Verse by a guy called Sacher Masoch, who is, I mean, the term sadomasochism comes from Masoch. Okay. And, but the whole thing that Deleuze says is that psychologists in the 20th century, when they were doing a taxonomy of pathologies, they put in like, oh, sadomasochism, oh, like as a pathology. But the whole point is that actually sadism and masochism are totally opposite. They have nothing to do with each other. So the whole work is on how masochism comes from Venus in Verse, and then he explains sadism out of, you know, Marquis de Sade. And but yeah, it's super interesting stuff. And it's not just about sex. That's the whole point. It's not like, it's not about sex.
So, if I can, yeah. If I can make one intervention of sorts, like in Hegel's frame, everything is master-slave dialectic. There's no master-slave and then something else. The idea, the theory behind it is that all relationships between any two people or between any individual and even an abstraction like society or the state or culture or religion or God evolve out of one fundamental relationship, and that relationship just goes through evolutionary stages as it tries to work itself out through this sort of fundamental laws of relationship. And you could disagree with Hegel and say his ground accounting of what relationship is simply false, or it's a projection, or like, dude, go to therapy. But like, in his view, the fundamental relationship and the reason why it's called master-slave is because two people encounter one another, two primitives really, and what they want is recognition from the other. And they have a fight to the death. It's super primal. Not because one wants to kill the other person, but because they each want to be seen as dominant. And then what happens in this moment of primal fight, like basically like a bar fight, but you know, going back 5,000 years, is that one of the people realizes that he's about to die, and he doesn't want that. So he's like, okay, uncle, and then becomes the slave. And then what happens, and it evolves over hundreds and thousands of years, and this is the engine that drives history. And why is it called a dialectic, by the way? Because ultimately it's the person in the inferior position that produces progress. So the dissatisfaction that I have as the slave and the underling leads to my hunger and my ambition and my innovation, and the master ultimately stagnates. So to go a little bit like left field here. The master is Accenture, but the slave is invisible. So like don't think it's bad to be a slave. Like, firstly, we're all slaves to something, and we're all masters to something else. But in terms of where does any good idea come from, throughout history, it always comes from the slaves. The slaves discovered every single contradiction within the master ideology.
And he can say that as a Jew, because this is literally Jewish history. No. This is Jewish history. No. This is the whole Exodus story is this exit from Egypt, from slavery into liberation. And that was the engine of progress. David and Goliath is like one of the greatest underdog stories of all time. And Gideon is an underdog story. And Joshua, you know, defeating Jericho is an underdog story. And actually, the history of Christianity is also this. Literally, that Christianity was the slave religion of the Roman Empire. And then it ultimately became like the whole foundation of medieval civilization.
The master says, okay, fine, you can be my slave. But then what happens is the master is dissatisfied because they don't want the recognition from an underling. Like, if somebody sort of that you don't respect is like, oh, you're amazing, right? That's not worth very much. If somebody that you super respect is like, wow, you're amazing, you're like, oh, so-and-so gave me a compliment. Yeah, right? So the master is ultimately very unhappy because he's made he's sort of made this person his source of value, but at the same time, that person can't give him any more value. Meanwhile, the slave has so much to prove because they're like, well, I had that humiliating moment. How do I regain my dignity? And in terms of history, what happens is that the master basically just becomes an owner, but the slave becomes the worker. And so it's the worker develops a relationship to craft. The worker has an inner life because work is hard. And so they've got to like retreat into their mind to feel like a sense of freedom. And then meanwhile, the master just stagnates. But what happens is as we get more modern, that relationship keeps flipping. So it's not like you could say there's one group that's masters and ones that's slaves. It's that this relationship almost inheres in all of our minds as an internal process. And Hegel was optimistic. So he thought that with a liberal democratic state of the 19th century, that we would all have equality with one another. And therefore I could look at you and you could look at me. And we'd finally get that recognition that produced all of this tension for thousands of years, which is that I recognize you as my equal and you recognize me as my equal. And through that experience of mutual recognition, I get to be your master and you get to be my master. And we get the benefits of feeling that slave dynamic that actually leads to that ambition and that hunger. Whereas if the pure master would actually be in a state of stagnation and complacency, which would not lead to self-consciousness. Self-consciousness is good. So,
which actually really does describe today's economy. You have the middle, the incredibly middle, like the domination of the middle class in Western societies. We are the most middle class societies in all of history, in terms of our psychology, maybe not in terms of actual inequality, but. Yeah. The middle class values have conquered even the Western aristocracy. You know, everyone's middle class. And that's like the Protestant work ethic. It's the idea that like we're all going to like work hard and define ourselves in terms of our capitalistic, work ethic and work product. But we all seek to make money with our capital, not work very hard. Schizophrenia in our capitalism, where we want to be Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice. That's just like has a rental income and doesn't have to work hard and just gets all the time and date. We want to be an Instagram influencer. Who's just like, full-time celebrity. But we also want to win at capitalism and be seen as like, being industrious and cause that's the primary realm of competition. And we actually don't know. We have a really confused relationship with work. We don't know whether we want to work more, and achieve more or want to work less and just collect.
And then within work, there's like being a manager of managers versus being an individual contributor, right? Which also has that dialectic within it. And I think like the radical point of Hegel, and the one that's near and dear to my heart, as a manager, is like actually the individual contributor is in a far better position. Like it's so burdensome to be a manager. And like the craft is actually in making something. It's not in managing somebody else's work. Which is just a side point on that. But if you look at societies that have political instability, it often correlates with the squeezing of the middle class, the loss of the middle class. And on the flip side, like one of the reasons why Marx arguably got it wrong about revolution and why the communism hasn't sort of taken over the world is that people love being middle class. And he thought that people were going to be so unhappy with their sort of position relative to the aristocrats that they would like destroy it all and burn it all down. But it turns out people just want to shop at Zara and get cheap shoes.
Can I add two things to two commentaries to Hegel here? I think that's to the discussion. One is, I think what you're pointing to, Zohar, is that when people talk about the master and slave dialectics, everybody focuses on the alienation of the slave. So like, oh, the people that work are alienated. But what Hegel says is that the master is also alienated. Because he's not in connection. He doesn't touch nature. He doesn't work, right?
Correct.
So, and that's kind of like an understated kind of phenomenon about the master and slave dialectic. I think the way this manifests today, if I can like allow myself this, you know, creative jump, is that people that don't work or don't do anything develop some sort of mental health problem. Because there's kind of this, I don't know, weird, mysterious, intrinsic drive of having to, you know, transform nature or like, you know, be in touch with matter. I don't know if that defines us as some sort of, you know, there's something to the species there. I don't know. But I think that's an interesting point in Hegel. And you can read Hegel as an alchemist also, which is another story, you know. And my second point was that to the master and to the chickening out of the slave or the becoming of the slave in the fight to death, because the slave becomes a slave when he chickens out. He's not the slave before, right? I've done some work on this because this connects to some of the stuff that I work on. But one interesting thing to point out is that it's not that the slave just chickens out. And I think this is... I'm going to say something about Accenture and all of that in a second, but it's that the master also allows the slave to live. There's an allowing to live, the permission to live. And some people have like discussed this today as like how does this manifest today, like biopolitically? So like we give you permission to life. We give you a right to live, you know, it's a right. It's like, well, when did it become a right? Like I was just born, you know, I don't know. So in the case of like how you could see this playing out between, let's say, a monopoly and a small business or like a small to medium business, is that how like do the monopolies or like do the big companies allow smaller enterprises to exist? Or is there that relationship between the two? Do they even know these exist? That was just like a thought I had in connection to that idea about Accenture. And so, yeah, all right.
We should have run the Hegel quote on Wednesday. Sounds like.
Oh, one thing I was gonna say though is that I got that quote from, I mean, it's from Leo Strauss, but that text of Leo Strauss is a commentary on Xenophon, on Xenophon's text on tyranny, which, by the way, which this is just like a side note, that whole like work of Strauss was kind of a conversation that developed with a guy called Alexander Kojève, who was like the perhaps one of the two most important readers of Hegel of the 20th century. So it was a discussion about politics. And so, yeah, I'm going to stop. And yeah.
Yeah, I want to go back to the Accenture thing, because Accenture, Invisible versus Accenture, is like Martin Luther, the original Martin Luther, versus the Pope. Right. Like the Protestant Reformation is a classic example of counterpositioning as a branding strategy. So he nails the thesis to the door, And the Catholic Church loses the battle for the Protestant Reformation the second they excommunicate him, the second they acknowledge him as a heretic, as a challenger, the second they basically take him as a credible threat, they elevate his status by giving him recognition. They would have been better if they'd ignored him. In the
they should have aqua-hired him, actually.
Correct.
Just buy him out. What's your price, bro?
Yeah. Well, Luther. Martin Luther was wearing red shoes. He was ready to go to war. He was not buyable. He was not bribable, to his credit. Interesting thing. I'm thinking about how to protect us from an inevitable acquisition offer if we succeed. So imagine we succeed at building a $25 billion company. And then Accenture at this point has grown from $200 billion today to whatever at their slow growth rate / fast growth rate at their size, 12% a year. So maybe they'll be $250 billion company, 10 times our size. And they will say, you know what, we'll offer you, they'll do a tender offer to shareholders, try to do a hostile takeover and say, we'll offer all shareholders twice the value. We'll offer you $50 billion for your $25 billion company. How do we protect Invisible from that scenario? Because the only reason in which they would offer us at that point, if they're paying double, 20% of their enterprise value, highly dilutive acquisition, is if they're scared, as if they're seriously scared. And there is definitely a strategy where you could actually use that recognition as a form of David and Goliath superiority. You just made us the inevitable disruptor simply by trying. But you have to get past the initial death move, which is the hostile takeover. How do you convince shareholders to say, no, don't take 2X. Why take 2X when we could be bigger than them in 10 years? And that is the trick, is like, you know, the whole thing that you said there, Zohar, that got me thinking is, what is it that creates the underdog's moral character, the chip on their shoulder that would make them do something as reckless as, attempt the revolt, you know? And this was true in the story of Exodus. You know, there was a lot of that was like, I don't know, should we leave Egypt? It's a little dangerous.
I'll tell you what it comes down to. And you'll forgive me because I don't know the C-suite of Accenture. So I'm not going to speculate on that. But
Julie Sweet is the CEO, and she seems by all accounts to be exactly that.
So we want the slave has one fundamental advantage whose endurance cannot be understated, and that is mission. Once you become quite large and incumbent, typically, like, what you want to do is simply preserve your success, and your mission becomes keep being successful. But you're not going to harness the sort of entrepreneurial disruptive spirit of people that, as to your point, have that chip on the shoulder and have a mission. Like, why do so many empires pretty much all crumble? Like, there are a lot of reasons, but like, one is essentially that they lose touch with their mission. And so once it becomes just about making money, it's like that attracts mercenary talent, you know, so you can have a nice house in the burbs. Those people aren't going to be like working late hours. Those people aren't going to be like taking risk and thinking creatively because they don't feel like owners. Like, why did the band of Israelites succeed against larger enemies? Because they were like, dude, like, God chose us to do a holy mission for all time, and we better win this battle. It wasn't about land acquisition. It was like, right. So I think the answer is like almost like you have to harness the power of religion or spirituality. And then that's what allows you to
overcome. I would interject that it doesn't have to be religion or spirituality, yeah, but it has to be belief, right? Like, okay, rock solid fundamental belief in something.
But something like metaphysical, like if you're like, I have a vision for how work is fundamentally going to change as a result of my technology or something like that. Like, there's something like so, like, it's like a magnitude jump in what you're trying to do. Like, you're trying to change the world as it is. Like, in my view, that is religion. Like say Abraham came on the scene, he saw the intertwinement of a certain pagan philosophy with the mistreatment of human beings. And basically, like, if you look at there's a commentary on the Tower of Babel story, in which every time a brick would fall from the top of the tower, everybody would mourn the loss of the brick, meanwhile, like the workers were just falling and people were like, okay, we'll find new workers. And so there's like an intertwinement between the tower itself, the vanity of this tower, and the way that people are even relating to the builders of the tower. And so like he created a moral revolution that was like, what if there was a different way? And I think that's like all, what it comes down to is like a moral revolution. And what's hard is sustaining that once you're successful. Like it seems easy to sustain the moral revolution when you have a $100 million market cap, but can you sustain it at $10 billion? Or is it just like at that point kind of a wash almost?
To be clear, I am not sure it's like Invisible definitely was a moral revolution when we were a 6-person company. Like that's how we felt at the time. But I am like increasingly finding it difficult to find the narratives that are going to really make it as true as it was back then in the next 5 years. And these things are gradual, right? Like they have a tendency for people to sort of keep saying them and paying lip service, but it sort of gets, you know, weaker and weaker. And then before you know it, nobody actually believes it. And everyone knows you're just kind of like slightly different, slightly above average company.
You know, what's
interesting? I have a question on this. So, I don't know if this is going to be phrased perfectly, but I'm hoping the sentiment comes across where if you have this moral belief on a change, which essentially I think the underlying context is a change to like the fundamental system, the power, the system in power, I suppose. How does that like square with the idea that you're still playing by the system in power rules by rebelling against them? I think for me, this dynamic, like it seems like the moral belief is always set to fail because it's still like playing by the rules of the system in power.
One more time.
I think there's different philosophies on it. Like, I think you can fight a guerrilla war, and feel on your moral high horse relative to, let's say, the British Army. Mm-hmm. And that feels so good, right? But at the end of the day, you're fighting because you want power. And so what happens when you win and they retreat and they're like, okay, great. Like you have your freedom, go write a constitution. Oh, well now all of a sudden it turns out it's not so easy to govern. I have a lot more sympathy for the British now. I think everybody goes through that turn as sort of you go from being powerless and saying like all power is bad to be like, here's some power. All right, now you give it a shot. And so that's where I think there's like revolution is kind of like the pre-seed. And then let's say that by the time you're getting to Series B, you're already at the reform stage. And that's what we see with Protestantism, to go back to like Francis is like, yeah, Luther was a radical. Are his descendants 500, 1,000 years later radicals? Or is it just a new Catholicism?
It is a new Catholicism for sure. Yeah, I mean the real Protestantism is like crypto or something, and not even that. I mean that's before you know it, that'll be the next thing that'll be.
I have a question.
Until like Pepsi is like a holder of $1 billion of Bitcoin on the balance sheet, right? And that's what you want. You want to be a hypocrite like that. Like that's winning. So it's like, and I think like, I think like, here's how I would put it in perspective.
That quote out of context. I think we should consider doing a separate podcast that is literally just like a drama, like a courtroom drama. That's all like a farce, like a farcical courtroom drama where we're all having to like defend ourselves in court against like theoretical accusations, disgruntled shareholders, cancel culture, whatever. I don't know, maybe we should call it canceled or something, like every cancelable thing. During the Lightning podcast this week, you said the goal is to become a hypocrite. Yeah. Can you explain why we should trust you?
When I was younger, I used to say, I'm never going to be that kind of person who repeats myself. I will never give the same speech twice. I will never do a stump speech. Like there's nothing that bothers me more than people that go around just saying the same motivational words. It's like, dude, like,
you know, like, the founding moment is always now.
Like be a person. Like I don't like if AI can just go and do the thing for you, then like you failed. But that being said, I have found myself repeating the same thing over and over again recently. And that is this example of Daniel Libeskind, who is a great architect, started out as an avant-garde artist who was making these very small scale sculptures that featured at the Venice Biennale. Nobody knew who he was other than other artists. They were actually called anti-sculptures. They were like very meta and very conceptual. And then he did the Holocaust Memorial in Germany, and he's done the New World Trade Tower. And he's a person of tremendous scale now. And the New World Trade Center building, only 4% of his blueprint was implemented because of all kinds of zoning laws, budget issues, politics, et cetera. And supposedly in the industry, like, this is a success. Like, Daniel Libeskind has 4% ownership, right? And it's like, wow, you got 4% instead of 1%? Bravo. Like, not only are you a great architect, but you're also a deft, you know, negotiator. That's what I mean by that's what I mean by hypocrisy is what you want. I mean that, like, a purist can look at that 4% and say this person compromised 96% of their vision. And as another person can look at it and say they built a building that every person, like, in the world knows and sees and people interact with, and it's now in the world. Like, well done. And so I think you can look at Luther's legacy or any legacy and say, this doesn't conform to the ideals. You can also look at it and say, wow, it's lasted for 500 years. That's pretty cool. I think, like, Luther himself was more of a day one kind of guy. And so that energy isn't the energy of, you know, the person you want actually managing the thing. But you do need that energy. So bring back to master slave. I think, like, the slave is the one that produces the Luther. And then when that Luther gets power and becomes a master, it all goes downhill from there. But it's also what you want. You want the merging of the master and slave. And then that's what I think a friendship is, ultimately. That's what I think separates the friendship in its lack of definition from this hero valet relationship, is that there's that instability that actually allows you simultaneously to have a sense of maybe superiority and a sense of inferiority. And those get merged into a state of equality. And it's always unstable and fragile. Like, if you take, like, the Jewish tradition as an example, we have this idea of a study partner called the chavruta. It was like a person that you learn Torah with, and they were your intellectual adversary. And the Talmud gives many examples of these relationships souring because one person bested their best friend in a debate, and all of a sudden the person that got bested felt a sense of shame and died of shame. And then, like, like, one of my favorite stories is this, basically this Rabbi Yochanan, who is said to be the most beautiful dude amongst the rabbis, and then this Reish Lakish, who was known to be the most sort of brute, strong guy. And that was evident in their learning styles. Like, the one just said the most graceful things, and the other one was, like, super logical and, like, would just come at you with full force. Like, but, you know, what does that mean? And what does that mean? And Reish Lakish wins this debate. And, Rabbi Yochanan wins the debate and then shames Reish Lakish. And Reish Lakish dies. And then Rabbi Yochanan's sad, and he's like, wait, I didn't mean to do that. Like, I need my friend back. Like, now who can I talk to? And they bring him a substitute study partner. And this guy just agrees with Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan will say something, and this guy will just flatter him like a psychopath. Like, oh, that was so beautiful. And the guy's like, no, like, I want that guy that would, like, knife me in every conversation. Like, where's that guy? So I think that's kind of a beautiful, like, illustration of what friendship involves in a way.
Man, I don't know. I sort of like his new sparring partner way better. I think that's a better better team member.
I mean, yeah, that rival is your friend kind of trope has been, it's very ancient. It brings to mind the story of Gilgamesh and Enkidu.
Yes,
I mean their first moment meeting is a fight, is like a challenge. And they're, like, matched equally in strength. And then they embrace and become best friends. And this is in a time period of, like, I don't know how many other, like, similarities in culture we'd have with them. You know, like, if you read the text, it's like they're still worshiping the fact that they eat bread, you know, as an important thing. And here there's a man who owns a city, basically owns everyone in the city. Decides that this wild man is his equal, but also not his equal, and is his friend. I just think it's interesting that that idea of friendship is that old.
Then I have a question for you, Cyrus, because I think this is looking a lot like opposites attract, right? These things are sort of yin and yang, and that's the dynamic that creates kind of this long-standing friendship that where one may fall, the other is strong. And honestly, I don't know much about this, but the first thing that popped into my mind, Cyrus, was Legolas and Gimli. And yeah. Like the dynamic of these two. And I don't know, like, is it true then that the best friendships are made out of these kind of yin and yang characters, or the best relationships?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to know that, but I think there are different kinds of dynamics. When you go into any point, they become a good relationship. It becomes a good base, but you need to choose what kind of friendship you have. That's how I feel about it. You know, if you're going to be a Legolas and Gimli, that can work. But as long as you really complement each other in the right ways, or you can be, you could be a friendship like Aragorn and Boromir, who they're very similar, but also very different in just one way, which is how they look at themselves. And we're just talking about the movies of Lord of the Rings. We're not going to discuss the differences between the text and the movies, but the key difference between them is that Aragorn has this self-doubt about his vulnerability as a man. And Boromir doesn't. He has his own doubts, but that's whether or not he's going to succeed to save his people. And so there's a lot of conflict between Aragorn and Boromir. But at the end, there's a lot of closeness. I don't think I'm doing my example any justice because I'm so my brain's all over the place. But
I think it's very good. And it's similar to the previous example of Enkidu and Gilgamesh. The Boromir, yes. Aragorn, and the Enkidu Gilgamesh are both very similar because they begin with conflict. And then at the end, there's this denouement where very tearfully, like, Aragorn realizes Boromir would have truly actually been one of his dear friends and loyal allies. And similarly, you know, Enkidu and Gilgamesh begins with the giant, like, wrestling match, like, fight to the death. And then they become like best brothers, and then they defeat the monster, and then eventually Enkidu dies as a consequence of that. And the what this brings up for me is in the Upanishads, there is the teaching: do not set your heart on another's possession, who sees all beings as his own self, and his own self as all beings, loses all fear. When a sage sees this great unity and his self has become all beings, then what delusion and what sorrow can ever be near him? And this is very hard for men specifically that are identify as alpha males. And this is where the whole master-slave thing comes in. Because men are so competitive with each other. They're competitive romantically. They're competitive economically. They're competitive in every way. And so it is one of the most healing relationships I have been through personally are my brotherly loves. Like, for example, you know, I was getting a voice memo just, I don't know, earlier this week from my best friend, who literally is, like, I consider him my adopted brother. And he was sharing about a great joy in his life, and I felt his joy. And that is one of the things I'm like, oh, you know, my soul is not just in my body. You know, I feel so connected with him. I feel like his happiness is my happiness. That is very mystical because you start to disidentify with Francis's good just being localized in this body. And actually, no, it's almost like Buddhist metta meditation. It's like, no. His good is my good. You know, and once you get to that feeling, well, that actually is sort of, you could argue that Buddhist metta meditation is like the real thing that keeps Lockean property rights protecting, you know, private property, is the fact that when we move beyond jealousy, which is what makes us want to steal property. When you actually get to the point where you want good for other people, that is when you can actually want them to have property, want them to have land, want them to have sex, want them to have romantic fulfillment, want them to have good things. And you don't view it as like a scarcity thing where it's like they have it, I don't.
You could also do meta meditation, and then you're like, I'm sitting in Bill Gates' house, and he comes in and he's like, why are you, what are you doing here? I'm like, well, we're all one, so you know.
I do want to, there is no Bill.
Okay,
I have something to say towards that actually, because I was just thinking of that. So Francis, what you're saying is when two people recognize the self in each other, that's when a true friendship is made. Yes. And I would argue that all this discussion about, okay, like what is a friend? Like what makes a friendship? Like all these, is it a complementary relationship? Is it a rival relationship? I think it's all of that is actually just a question on how do you get a friendship started? And the two recognizing the self in each other is the end point. Is what occurs. It doesn't matter like how your friendship starts and what it's based on, but it's that proximity and that constantly working with each other that then unlocks that view of each other and that intimacy and that view of each other, that then it doesn't, that then you have that my win is your win is my win, because you've spent so much time with each other that it's blossomed. So all this conversation about what is a friendship is really a conversation about what's the best way to start a friendship. You know, what's the framework? What's the support for the tree as it grows until it gets to the point where it no longer needs that framework. And then they're both just in this spiritual oneness with each other.
What if there's no, what if the best way to start a friendship is accidental? Because no two true friendships are alike. The same way that no two true loves are alike. And that's why if you're trying to find your ex-girlfriend and your next girlfriend, then, you know, you're looking in the wrong place, because the next girlfriend is going to be your next girlfriend. Every you know, miracle is sui generis. Every person is going to have a fundamentally different chemistry with you, right, Nico?
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to how we met, or
yeah,
yes, yeah, 3 years ago, right? I think 3 years ago.
That's right. Yeah. And you still had better fashion than me.
Well, I want to bring up a different, like another example of Tom and Jerry.
Nice.
You know, because let's look at Tom and Jerry for a moment here. You know, who's actually the master in that one? And who's actually the slave? Because here's Tom. He's like, oh, right? And then there's Jerry, who's like, oh, but, you know, I'm actually smarter and I'm outwitting. But, you know, and it's just this really interesting dynamic. And when they do become friends, at some point, they, you know, sometimes they do decide to call it, you know, a truce for a moment. But are we satisfied with that? Do we really want that, you know, in that relationship? So, you know, I think it's an interesting thing, because even their friendship is sort of based on this master-slave dynamic. And it's almost like predicated on like, we were once foes, you know, and now we're not, but it's not always going to be like this. So
I love Tom and Jerry growing up so much.
Yeah, so good.
It would, what you just ask is a version of the drama question, which is, if there was no drama, would we watch the movie? You know, if nothing bad happened, if there was no problem to solve, like, would you watch a 3-hour movie about heaven where it just got better and better and there were literally no problems and nothing, there was no needs, there was no problems, there was no drama, zero? Would it hold your interest for how long?
I don't think our brains can conceive of that realistically. I don't think humanity exists without conflict, whether it's external or internal. I think we would cease to be human if that state was possible.
further up and further in.
But my mind went to David Attenborough documentaries. Because like I could watch like 6 hours straight of Planet Earth, but like what's funny is like there is conflict there. There's the conflict of like, how will this little creature find its food, or like look at this lion eating a gazelle, and you're like, oh yeah, like more
a young lion.
And then there's that meta, yeah. The meta conflict, which is like, isn't this heaven so beautiful? Well, guess what? Human beings are destroying it, and if you don't do something soon, it will all be gone.
Oh yeah. At the end of every one, man. Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, the children's guide to the universe, right? Like, I mean, oh, the little ant there. It's not a little ant. Like, it's not like, you know, it doesn't have this kind of emotional life that you're talking about. You're just like overlaying this on top of this, you know, nature. We don't understand nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're telling this beautiful story about, like, you know, you know, the world doesn't really care.
I think that's a great point, Nico, is that we almost apply human conflict. Like, we watch David Attenborough and we think like a cheetah chasing a gazelle, and we think of it in terms of conflict, when in reality, yeah, it's not conflict
actually,
at all. It's just the progression of nature.
Yeah. It's interesting you say this, because there's like one hypothesis that actually all human myth, or all our myths, are just a mimesis from what happens in nature. So for instance, there's one French writer that says that the myth of Medusa actually comes from looking at the praying mantis, you know? I mean, the archetype of the Medusa, you know, like the vampire women, you know, like the... I talked about this with Anne recently.
Like femme fatale.
Yeah, right. Yeah, femme fatale stuff, yeah. It comes from, like, you know, looking at the praying mantis. Like, look at the birds of paradise, like, is that nature? Is that our conception of nature? Like, oh, you know, like the stupid animal going to like get his food. No, like there's all this crazy weird stuff going on that we don't understand. Mating, you know, mating rituals, and who says animals don't have culture, you know?
Mm-hmm. Your comment that stories are all children's guides to the universe, which is obviously true for adults as well, is why myth is our first value in Invisible Values 2.0. Because myth is the ultimate onboarding technology and the inescapable onboarding technology. you have a child come into the world. How do you get that child up to speed on this crazy place? Well, you start telling them stories. And guess what? No matter what stories you tell them, whether they're literally myths or whether it's Planet Earth, or whether it's stories about your life, or any story, like literally any stories, inevitably they go right back to archetypal dynamics. And the art, like literally in this conversation right now, there's a whole bunch of archetypes going on. Like, even look, we're wearing costumes. This begs the question of whether story and archetype is literally part of the nature of reality itself, or whether it is just our projection on top of it as meaning-making machines, and actually it's all made up and it's not real, and the archetypes are not real. I'm actually of the Platonic view that, if anything, the archetypes are more real than the ideas are more real than things, but certainly as real as things.
I mean, there's this would take a long time, but you can bridge those two positions very easily. Like,
show us. Yeah,
I'm not gonna. No, I mean, it's gonna take me 20 minutes.
I tell this story every time, but for me, the bridge between the sort of abstract and then the hyper tangible is this story from the Zohar, my namesake, where a guy comes from the country, so he's like a country bumpkin, to the city, and he goes to all these different pastry shops, and he asks the people, like, okay, what is this pastry made from? And they're like, it's made from wheat. And he just goes through every pastry, is like, what is this made from? And they're like, wheat. And he's like, well, I come from a place that makes wheat, so I know all these things. And then the narrator says, like, Because he knew the essence of all things, he tasted not of the pastries, and therefore he missed out. This is like a parable for the fact that you can have a reductionist worldview, but like the beauty is in the application. Like, okay, great. You know, all the archetypes, let's say there are 12 of them or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. whatever construct you have, fine. But like, give me the pastries, like mix and match. Let's go, like iterate. That's why I like generative AI, because it's like, it takes the same pace. It takes the same wheat, but spits out a different pastry each time. It never gets old.
Aristotle.
I see that archetypes are another extension of pattern making, and that the universe is just pattern, right? It's just pattern over pattern. Like even the way, you know, there's structures of molecules and atoms, et cetera. It's just all patterns. So maybe it's that we as humans, we make meaning from those patterns, but they're still patterns.
This is a conversation we had recently on, I think, on nihilism. I don't know if it was like last week, but I mean, my point of why I can't explain it in 20 minutes, because you have to explain the problem of nihilism. The idea being that, like, if there is no, let's say, archetype, no, you know, axial substratum, whatever, and there is a void, no? Well, how can you, you know? The problem is that... there is no such thing as not positing some sort of universal, even if it's nothing. So most people, and bringing it to like, you know, the corporate world, is like, if your understanding of what you're doing is just like, you know, bringing the bread home, you know, and kind of this very senile, kind of modern, empty myth, to put it in a way, that's the myth, you know, that's the myth that you're being sold. There is no, let's say, oh no, everything else is BS, like this is the underlying substratum. No, that's one myth there, you know, that's one way of living, it's just one. So this is kind of my way of doing this. It's like, there is no such thing as like not having a myth. You do have a myth, you just like don't own the fact that it's a myth, you know. So contracts. Good contracts.
How do we make the myth of lightning the ultimate myth? This podcast, there's a million podcasts. They're all telling myths. How do we make this podcast the most interesting one?
Well, by getting rid of all myths. I mean, this is the magic of the Enlightenment. It's like they created the Magna myth by saying, hey, no, everything else is bullshit, basically. So like, this is us, you know?
I want to hear Anne's thoughts.
It's a branding question. We should definitely hear from Anne. I mean, Galadriel.
I'm gonna pass on this one.
all these references and talk about the master and slave relationship. I just keep bringing up the Star Wars rule of two. There's always a master and an apprentice, one to hold the power, the other to crave it. It's just, I'm thinking in Star Wars and Lord of the Rings now, thanks to you guys. I
very much appreciate that. So thank you, Cyrus.
I'm going to have to pop open some movies this weekend.
But Anne, that competition between brands for moral supremacy, imaginative supremacy, mind share in people's heads, emotional loyalty, like what do you think actually at the end of the day creates the superior brand story identity?
So I think, like, Sohar said something to this, but the idea that, so I think it's based on the idea of competition. And I think that obviously brand superiority doesn't exist without competition. And I think that the best brands do two things. They recognize people where they are, but they also give them something to aspire to. And so I think that one of the best things, like Francis, one of your brands, like Disney, is that Disney essentially doesn't ask you to be anything but yourself, right? But it simultaneously gives you a place where you can be your happiest self. So it doesn't ask like you to be a different person so much. It doesn't push you like to be somebody else, but it simultaneously gives you something to aspire to and gives you a transformational experience. And I think that a lot of brands, if you kind of look at them through this lens, they do that. Let's say fashion brands, right? they aren't saying, oh, change yourself. Like they're saying, oh, I see you, but you can be better with me, you know? And so I think it's simultaneously this tension dynamic of meeting people where they are, but then allowing them to participate in a better version.
So good.
Can I add on one idea? I don't know. I don't think this contradicts, but I know in the early modern period, sprezzatura became important, or maybe even earlier in the Renaissance, which is this idea of appearing effortless, even though we probably did put a lot of effort into it. And I think it's a cousin concept to this idea of like virtuosity, right? You see the violinist playing in the subway. And it looks like just another person busking, and then it turns out to be like a famous person who went to Juilliard or whatever that was doing it in disguise. And I feel like, right, like you can look at this screen, it's like, I don't know, six talking heads. There's a certain like casualness and informality here that kind of is sprezzatura. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but like we also know how to grind. Like I put in my Sitzfleisch. My butt time, like sitting in a library, right? Like there's a reason I can talk about Hegel for 12 hours straight, because like I was a masochist. I was a masochist because I wanted to understand like why things are the way they are for years. And there's a myth to that journey for myself. And I'm sure each of us has our own highly personal reason for why we went on the path that we did. And people don't see that suffering. And that's fine. Like we don't need to show how the meat is made. If I'm gonna mix the metaphor, but I think like there's a way in which we give people the illusion that it's easy. That's part of what draws them in. And then it's like, okay, but you want this? Well, now you have to suffer. Like you really just want to like be a drive-by tourist who's like getting a daily microdose of meditation, or you like actually want to read the Phenomenology of Spirit, which is like 400 pages of impenetrable prose. And not everyone's going to want to do that. Both.
That's what we're doing here, right? Right, Cyrus?
Mm-hmm. No, what I'm saying is, I'm not saying everybody needs to be a masochist in the same way. I'm saying that there's a certain effortlessness that comes out of being highly determined. And I know we all have a real work ethic, but none of us is leading with that because effort is super passe. But I think that the myth is grace. The myth is grace, and the reality is work, 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 yeah. Work, work.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think too, like it's the idea. There's a famous story from Picasso where you know he's sitting at a cafe and a woman walks by and says, "Oh, you're Picasso." She goes, "Draw me something," and he goes, "Okay." And he takes 30 seconds and he draws her something, and he's like, "That's $30,000." And she was like, "What? You did that in 30 seconds?" He's like, "No, it took me 30 years to be able to do that in 30 seconds." And so I think it's this idea of like instantaneous takes a long time.
Lightning. Mm-hmm. One lightning bolt.
Yep.
Right?
Takes a but long the, time the, for the conditions. Clouds to gather.
Yeah, exactly. The conditions that make for lightning take a lot. Yeah.
But I think that's another way of saying what you were saying, which is meeting people where they're at and challenging them.
Yeah.
Where people are at is instant gratification. Like they want to order inspiration as a service, the way they can click on the, like a seamless button and get like fish tacos delivered to them in 10 minutes. And it's like, fine, we'll give you a little bit of that. But also like this is a spiritual practice. And what if you like became a completely different person as a result of integrating it in your life in some way?
Get them to love the masochism. Turn them into masochists. Actually, yeah.
I think we should like do this position like next time, but like that is sadism. That's not masochism.
Can we start the next podcast with Nico giving us a breakdown on both? Like, I think the world needs this, Nico.
Yeah.
Like, come with slides. Yeah.
I think the world is sadistic, and Marquis de Sade is. If I was going to scrub anyone from the canon, it would be him. Like I think that's the one. I think that's the one thinker that we know too well without reading. which is basically the idea of like just be evil, and like if anyone like tells you that you're wrong, then like they're wrong for telling you that.
But that's Kant's position. That's the whole point. You know, that's not the Marquis de Sade. That's Kant actually. So that's like the true. You know, this is something that could be like, you know, could like, you know, melt your brain if you understood it. But actually, that's Kant's position. It's like that the fundamental nature of human being is to be evil.
Don't deny the validity of my feelings. Don't deny the validity of my feelings. Like, I can do whatever I want, and if you tell me otherwise, then like you're bad.
Sexual Personae by Camille Paglia is that first chapter is pure dynamite, and she makes quite a defense of Sade. As significant to understanding human nature.
If you want the worst character there are, you can Google Gilles de Rais. Like that, you have a worse person there to like, you know, have a fun time with. Like there's a bunch of others that are way worse than a monkey.
But like you got to this out before we descend into sadism.
Yes.
Desaad is the reason though that we have this avocado toast culture. Like where it's just like. I just get to do whatever I want and feel noble, and nobody can challenge me or tell me why I should like change. And they're the one with the pathology. And so now we move towards like total inclusivity and acceptance in a way that I think is just like completely like an overreaction. Like clearly like there should be room to work on yourself, but no, like anyone giving you any negative feedback is like out of line. And like clearly bigoted or whatever, you know. Like
I would say that I think Disney would be the culprit here, but
culture and invisible. That's definitely the way we run things here.
Yeah. What's that?
Well,
just kidding.
Alrighty, so with that, guys,
with the sadism.
Yeah, before we descend even further, that we're gonna wrap it up for today, guys. Thank you so much for joining Zohar and Francis, Genevieve, Nico. I hope you all had a great time discussing this with each other, and I hope those of you listening enjoyed it as well, because I was immensely educated and entertained. Until next time.